to the SEI podcast series, a production of the Carnegie Mellon Software Engineering Institute. The SEI is a federally funded research and development center at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A transcript of today's podcast is posted on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts. My name is Suzanne Miller. I'm a researcher and senior member of the technical staff here at the SEI. And today, I am very happy to introduce to you very good friends of mine and colleagues, Timothy Chick and Gene Millick, both of whom are fellow researchers here at the SEI. At the SEI, Tim and Gene work with both commercial industry and government organizations in helping them improve their overall performance based on the organization's goals and objectives. They are responsible for defining, developing, and transitioning into practice high-performance software and systems engineering practices based on Agile principles. In today's podcast episode, we will be discussing how to move from process-based to performance-based improvement. And you both know this is a topic that I fully support and engaged with in my own research as well. So I want to welcome both Gene and Tim.
Hey, thanks for having us.
All right. So for those of our listeners who are just embarking on some kind of improvement effort, would you explain the difference between process-based improvement and performance-based improvement? They both begin with P, so that could be confusing.
And Tim, I'd like to take a stab at that. I've been at the SEI maybe too long, 21 years, and so has Sue, so I'm not the only one.
We started about the same time.
Tim is a brilliant young engineer, and he often challenges me with, why the hell did you do it that way? Okay. So when the
sometimes you have a good answer.
Once in a while, I can remember that far back, actually. Well, we started when the CMMI Institute took the CMMI, which I spent a lot of years working on and developing, actually. Tim would ask, well, okay, DoD wants you to do something new, something innovative. What's the next thing? And we're struggling with what's the next thing. And then Tim came by and says, well, why did you do process improvement to begin with? And so I started thinking back and looked at the environment in the early 90s. And I would go to customers and we would look at best practices. Remember Watson, the best practices?
Yeah.
And I can remember talking with senior software people and saying, you need a software development plan. And they'd say, why? I have a project plan. Why do I need a software development plan? I said, well, where's your configuration management? He said, well, we're controlling our source code. What else do we need? And I realized that back then an infrastructure wasn't in place because I did measurement at the time. And I remember talking with groups saying, I get more metrics out of a little league baseball game than I got out of a multi-million dollar software effort. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the measurement systems weren't in place to get to performance. So what did we do? We looked at those companies that had good processes in place, and we said, if you were to mimic those processes, you would get good performance.
Okay? You're more likely to get good performance.
You're more likely to get good
performance. Because there's more than your process that's going to determine that.
So the point was that, and we at the beginning, we said, you shouldn't do this totally. You should measure things. But they never really, most of them didn't. They said, well, I want to get better. So if I look at people that do things well and I imitate them, do what they do, I would get better. So we would measure performance. As a proxy of performance would be our practices. So how do we know we got better? We started level 2, now we're level 3. Well, we didn't measure performance. What's kind of interesting, I was just thinking back about that time. Does anyone remember the Fosbury flop? If you're at track and field, when you did the high jump, you would normally jump straight over with your face looking down. And there was this young man out of California that did a backflip over the high bar. And he revolutionized the high jump. Why? Because he kept winning matches. Okay? So if you start looking at performance improvement versus
process
performance, it's if you were a golfer and you could have a textbook swing but never hit a ball, that's process improvement. Okay?
That's not a terrible analogy.
Okay, but well.
Yeah, okay.
Well, this is an informal one.
Yeah.
So the point is, and Tim kind of inspired this, because when we go out now and we talk to organizations, a lot of that infrastructure is in place. You don't have to say, why don't you have a project plan for software? They do. You don't have to say, why aren't you having configuration management? They typically
well,
do.
Well, and if you go back, I'm going to jump in here out of my interviewer role into some of my history. Those models were based on the fact that when we looked at the software industry in the 80s and we compared it to, say, the manufacturing industry, which is where some of these principles came from, you know, you look at Deming principles and some of the things that came out of the total quality movement, they had basic practices in place that allowed for the measurement.
Right.
And the as you're saying, the software industry didn't. And so those models were meant as a surrogate for things that were missing from the environment to be able to do performance-based improvement. And theoretically, when you get to the higher levels of those models, you're supposed to switch over to performance-based improvement. Sometimes it happened, sometimes it didn't.
Yeah, so. What we're finding is a lot of organizations now have the ability. They have configuration management. They have tools that are actually collecting data.
Let's go through defect tracking they have. They have some sort of time accounting or project management system.
Estimation.
The development environments very often have that information in there.
Yeah.
So there's much more data than 20 years ago.
But they're not using it. That's what
we're
finding. People have different pockets of data, but they're not coming together and actually using it for performance.
So I want to claim success where I possibly can. I think one of the big successes of process improvement was that those things are now taken for granted. You're going to have an environment that collects that data. You're going to have a certain set of tools, testing tools, defect tracking tools. All of that's now expected to be in place that wasn't 20 years ago.
Although I have to tell you, there's still some environments I run into that are not quite as advanced as that.
I went to one customer. Why did they call me? They didn't have
any source
code.
It's certainly more prevalent.
They lost their source code. I actually worked with a company who lost their source code, not to one product, but to multiple products. And they didn't realize it until one of their customers came back and said, I'd like you to update my product. And they couldn't.
Yeah.
They had to.
There's still some gaps, but
by far that's the exception.
But the majority.
Majority have mainstream and have accepted certain practices are just fundamental good engineering practices software.
That's true. And I guess what I want to say is that when you're looking at I see them as two different lenses. There's the lens of process, which is a lens that is about looking at behavior of individuals and groups. And then there's the lens of performance, which is looking at what is the outcome mm-hmm. of all that behavior. Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, the performance-based improvement focus is one that is really trying to integrate the behavior with the goals and the outcomes. Right. And that to me is that's the new thing, is that we're not divorcing the, you know,
process.
We used to say process versus product. We're not doing that. Mm-hmm. We're saying, no, yeah, you have to have enough process so you can pay attention to the product, but process without goals and outcomes attached is going to get you the golf swing without a ball.
So let's go with that a little bit. It's something that breaks my heart as a software professional researcher. I go to many software executives, and I say, what's important to you? Is quality important to you? Yes, we got to have a quality. Then you ask questions, what's your defect density? I don't know. What's your cost of quality? I don't know. And it's embarrassing, okay? And it doesn't go anywhere. What I find so amazing about this process, the checkpoint diagnostic, is that just as Tim said, they're collecting this data. They don't know what to use it for. So if you can use the data they have and come up with defect densities and compare, all of a sudden light bulbs go off. If you can look at rework and cost of quality and show it to them on their own site, light bulbs go off.
But to go back to the process part, though, is you also map it back to say, what practices are you not doing that are considered best practices? And then if you use some historical data based on industry, you might even be able to project the return on investment of actually adding certain best practices that are missing with their own data. And that's how you actually set performance-based improvement goals. Then you try something, you try to implement something, and then you can remeasure it using the data that you already have. You can collect.
So you mentioned
re-evaluate.
Checkpoint diagnostic tool, and I want you to tell our audience what is that, and you know, sort of how did that come about? What is it being used for in this overall performance-based improvement effort?
So let me take a few minutes to describe the flow of the checkpoint diagnostic. It's a very short, inexpensive diagnostic compared to a full-blown appraisal. Okay, And it starts out with a dialogue of what's your business goals and objectives relative to software, what's important. Is it quality, high quality levels? Is it cycle time? Is it delivering features? What is your business value to software, first thing? Then what you do is you map that business value to a best practices model. So if quality is important, what are the quality practices that helps you get there? In some standard model we like to have, okay, best practices model. Then that's half of it. The other half of it is, and this I have to really give Tim credit, because when he proposed this, I kind of thought he was crazy. He still might be crazy, but this time it worked really well.
You told me it wouldn't work.
I told you
it wouldn't work. There's no way they'd be able to do it.
Well, when you get on site,
never tell Tim that.
I know. I love a challenge, don't I?
Well, as you go through the best practices model on the left one side of the ledger, on the other side of the ledger, you're keeping an inventory, creating a data model. What tools do you have? What data is in the tools? What records do you keep? What data is in the records? Okay? And you create a big inventory of those, and you have them show it to you. And what you find, and you know, Tim, is that most places don't know all the data they have. Someone knows about the defect tracker. Someone else knows about the project planning. Someone else knows about configuration management.
And Tim's got a spreadsheet over here that nobody knows anything about. And so what to do? Data for the last 5 or 10 years.
So the next step is, once you do that, is to go, okay, so each of these individuals or these different departments have certain pieces of data. They all align up with certain aspects of your roadmap. Maybe it's a release, maybe it's certain milestones. And you go, okay, I want all of this data. And oh, by the way, this person has this data, this person has this data. And I want you to align all that data with these milestones or these release mm-hmm. events, right?
Or phase gates, however
phase gates, whatever. Yeah. And most their business structure will dictate what that is.
Yeah.
And then you take that and we really do a qualitative analysis where we go, okay, what does this data mean? You know, what is your defect density if they have size and defect data? What is their return on investment? How much are they spending?
What's
are they hitting the schedule?
To
time
average,
to release,
yeah.
right? Those types of things. And then we report that back to them, right? And then because we also did that qualitative piece, that model-based, you know, process,
practices,
traditional
yeah.
practice-focused one, we can go back and say, here's what your data says. Here's how your data compares to some industry, because we do have lots of industry mm-hmm. data. You know, and then we go, okay, where are your weaknesses, right? Well, these types of weaknesses usually align up with these types of practices that are either non-existent or kind of weak in terms mm-hmm. of your implementation. And then management executives can go, okay, if I focus some energy here, I would expect these numbers to improve.
Right.
Right?
Because there are certain practices that do have pretty strong corollaries to certain improvements in performance.
In certain environments. If
in
you don't measure it, you
that's
don't
right.
know.
Environment is all, yeah. But you yeah. can make some of those assertions in environments once you've got the whole context, and that can be a much more powerful, in my mind, argument for doing this than
right.
Model X says you should do this.
Right.
So
right?
It's more encouraging to people to actually yeah. change their behaviors. They have numbers in which they can actually determine whether they've actually improved, right? That's
right.
The biggest thing I found going out with doing model-based improvement, right, was, well, we now do the practice. Great. Are you a better organization because of it?
Yeah. And right. I don't know how much you may not have been here long enough, but I know you remember there was a guy out at Boeing who's now at CMU who, when he would receive appraisal results, process appraisals from any of his suppliers or his organizations, he demanded certain data and
yes.
performance. He was the only one I knew that do it, but he was the only one I knew that did that. But he had that sense
yes.
already that if you just do the practices and you don't see improvement in your performance, I'm not getting a good deal on
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's some precedent for this, just not in,
yeah.
in
so
this
like,
kind
like
of
like I used to
format.
Always tell like a new process improvement group that says, you know, we're getting ready to do this new initiative. We're going to do this improvements. You know, at some point, your sponsor is going to say, okay, Tim, we just spent $500,000 on this process improvement initiative. What did I get
mm-hmm.
for my money?
Mm-hmm.
And the time to prepare to answer that question is not when he asks it. It's now
yeah.
before we start doing
right.
the initiative. Because that's the only time where you're going to get the baseline data to to be able to try something new and then say, okay, did I actually improve or was it just different?
So tell me a little bit about what you've seen so far in using it. What kind of contexts have you been using the diagnostic in?
Yeah.
And what kinds of results, either in terms of motivation or in terms of actual performance, that you can talk about that you've seen so far?
I'll talk about one example, let Tim talk about another one. And this is really short and sweet, but it condenses a lot of data collection and analysis. We had one organization that was in a regulated industry, but the software was not in their product. Their software was a utility product that the customers used to make their product more useful. I can't talk any more than that. And so we went in and we did the diagnostic. What they wanted to do was put more features in their product so that their customers would have more value than the competitors.
Okay.
Because the product they were selling is actually a commodity product. You can get it from multiple places. So this software utility created the competitive advantage, right? And what they found is their marketing people said, hey, we need to put more into this and so we can get more value to our customers, and we weren't able to. So we went through the checkpoint diagnostic, concentrating on those sets of issues. Long story short, we filtered through and had a couple of deep dives into data. Some of it was actually in manual format. And when we looked at it, the last release was 7,000 hours, okay? They found 1,800 hours of rework in the requirements phase of development. And so when we looked at the processes, we saw some issues in R&D especially.
Mm-hmm. Requirements development.
And we mapped those two together. Now that is pretty much a no-brainer. That says, okay, you have 7,000 hours total and 2,000 hours were in rework in requirements. What do? You beef up your requirements and drive it down. And you can make a very compelling business case, okay, value proposition for adding resources there to get more out,
more
the,
value.
Other, out mm-hmm. the other side. So that was, you know, pretty dramatic no-brainer.
What about you, Tim? What's your example?
So the example I have is a company called us at the SCI and asked us to help them with some process improvement. And so what we proposed to them is that we start off just doing this checkpoint diagnostic. Let's see what your problems really are. Then we can figure out how to fix it, how to address it. And there's another regulated, it's a medical device company. First question we asked is, well, why are you calling us, right, as a consultant type of
where's your pain?
Engagement? Where's your pain, right? And for them, it really was they were missing their delivery dates. But even worse than that, what the real is causing pain is that their customers were reporting defects in their product that was requiring them to do patches to their products, right? And so the customers were constantly having to reinstall their product.
Right. And in regulated environments, that means new certification,
new verification
cycles, and all that kind of stuff.
So
it can be very,
very
costly.
Very costly, very painful. Well, they were actually in this cycle for about 2 years, and they weren't delivering any new features, really. Right, so if you're, you know, at the top of your field, your competition is always nipping at your heels, and if you're not going to, you know, continuously innovate,
right,
they're going to catch up, right? And so they had double pain points, and so what their data really showed was they had a quality issue, right? And in fact, they could actually predict based on the amount of defects being found by their verification and validation phase, they could actually predict how many defects their customer was going to complain about, right? And they didn't realize this, right? But once we did the checkpoint,
you could see the correlation.
We
of the
had
data.
The data, and it was a pretty strong correlation. And I basically said, you know, for every so many defects found here, you're going to find that many there. And they were just at all that, oh, we actually have leading indicators on our customer's experience, right?
Nice.
Or bad experience, right?
Yeah.
That verifies it. And the other part was project planning, project monitoring, controlling. They really weren't using real measures. It was all engineering judgment, a lot of guessing.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw that some of that data was kind of weak that they did provide. But we analyzed it. We proposed some improvement ideas. They decided to use the team software process, another tool that we have in our toolkit. And so that really took a more quantitative, more measure-focused, self-directed type teaming environment.
Right.
And that combined with the verification validation and some of their testing features and beefing some other things up. They, at the end, they basically cut the number of defects being reported in terms of lines of code. So,
as a size surrogate.
As a size surrogate. They cut them in half, right? And they also, for the first time in quite a while, they're now delivering new features, new capability to their customer. But the biggest part is in all of that, they went through an acquisition where they got bought by another company. And usually what happens there is well, why are you got to justify everything over again, right? That data really came valuable to answering that question. I see here on the book that you spent so much money for these people called the Software Engineering Institute. What did we get for it?
Yeah.
Right?
And, yeah.
And they were able to answer that question to go, you know, here's what our pain was. We weren't being innovative. We weren't delivering products. Here's what our data said about us. We did this improvement initiative. Took about a year. We redid the evaluation based on new releases delivered to the customer. And here's our new numbers. You can see the contrast for yourself.
Cool.
Right?
Very cool.
So that's really some of the power of using performance-based and not just relying on practice-based improvement.
So whenever you have a tool like this diagnostic, what happens is you start seeing new gaps and you start seeing new things that we need to research as the SEI to help people get better performance.
Right.
Have you seen any of those? What kinds of things do you see as the future research in this area?
If you don't mind, I'll go first. I think the things we're looking most intently at integrating into this is the architectural principles we have here at the SEI. We're known around the world for that. And we'd like to make sure that, you know, once they get the basic pain points in place, there's advantages to design, architecture, product lines, and so forth that needs to be put in there.
Okay.
Some of those things are not really covered by any of the current models. So we've been pretty much using the capability maturity model integrated, CMMI. You could use some others that are out there. There's the software body of knowledge,
right,
for example.
Right.
So you could go to other sources if you don't want to use the CMMI. But a lot of them don't take the deep dive or the large breath that the CMMI does.
Right.
And even the CMMI, they're its weakest in terms of architecture and some of the other more engineering-based capabilities.
Excellent.
And then we'd love to integrate more of our acquisition technology.
Gene is looking pointedly in my direction at this point. I will just tell you, for those that you can't see him, since that's one of my big areas of work. Yes, I get that.
Yeah. And so the other answer to my answer to that question would be is, I'm hoping we can do more of them. And then what we'll be able to do is actually have more industry data across multiple industries or whatever, that we can begin doing more performance statistical and actually
more quantitative, more empirical analysis.
Yeah, to better benchmarks that are out
there. Gotcha. Right. Excellent. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining me today. This was a wonderful conversation, and I hope the rest of you enjoy it too, as much as we did. For more information about the SEI's research in this field, please visit www.sei.cmu.edu/process. Hasn't changed to performance yet.
No.
And click on the research tab. This podcast is available on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcast and on Carnegie Mellon University's iTunes U site. As always, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email us at info@sei.cmu.edu. Thank you.